Translating this generalization into the SEC's legislative program between 1966 and 1970, you did not have a situation in which there was total rejection and the declaration of war on the part of the industry. On the other hand, you had very significant organizations who were dedicated to opposing, in part or in whole, specifics of the legislative proposals, and so it was a very mixed situation. There were so many recommendations that the SEC had come up with and embodied in the legislation, and then the potential for rulemaking after the legislation was enacted, that the proposals embroiled the whole industry one way or another and forced everyone to try to figure out how they were impacted or potentially impacted. From the point of view of a trade association, that kind of situation, while very complicated and difficult, also presented the opportunity of intra-industry negotiation, because everyone was now impacted one way or another, and so that you couldn't have a situation where you had some people saying black and other people saying white, and never the twain shall meet.
Your job is to harmonize all these interests.
To harmonize the interests, and in a way which is not simply for the purpose of presenting a united front, but presenting a united front which is reasonable and plausible from the point of view of reaching a result. I think the Institute, under my predecessors and under my successors, has been uniquely, and I use the word uniquely, full understanding of its dictionary definition, unique among financial trade associations as not reaching consensus merely for the point of view of reaching a consensus to reject the government's position, but to not come forward with a consensus position which was which is objectively doomed to failure. Most of the four-year period between 66 and 70 was devoted to, on the one hand, trying to develop the arguments to the extent that we could, opposing the SEC's legislative proposals, but one step behind the curtain, trying to achieve an industry consensus on proposals that would have a chance of enactment.
Was this Augenblick's position? Was he the one who sort of brought this in as a guiding principle?
Bob was Bob was a good lawyer. Had been in practice as a lawyer for many years, and lawyers are generally compromisers. It was very strongly my position that there was absolutely no long-term solution to the SEC's legislative program, except the enactment of a legislative program that was would not go away, and that all that could happen over time was the erosion of public confidence in the industry, and then simply through passage of time there'll be some event or some scandal or something which would provide the engine of more punitive legislation.
How well received was that position within the industry?
Generated some sympathy and more sympathy as time went on. During the late 50s, performance had been pretty good. During the 60s, performance was not as good. That this is my memory. It could be not borne out by numbers as such, but by the perception of people in the industry that the climate was not as good from the point of view of industry, the industry as it had been in the 50s. But it all comes down to the specifics, developing a response to the specific recommendations that the commission had made, and that a good deal of the time was devoted to that, developing positions which we thought would be could be acceptable, and then taking that around the industry, and you get agreement on this one, and you move on to the next one. And sometimes, more often than people care to admit, problems can be solved through communication. When you get to things like government regulation and new wine being prepared that nobody has tasted before, communication becomes all the more important as to how you're going to meet that situation. Also, there's always tremendous misunderstanding on the part of industry of what the government is really after. Very often, much less often than people think, the government has a specific objective in mind. They don't. They usually have a process in mind, or they're looking for a way to rechannel existing practices rather than ending them. Let me put it this way. The whole question of advisory fees was the centerpiece of the legislative program. The government did not come in and say 0.5% of assets per year is too much and it ought to be 0.1%. That was in no one's mind. The SEC staff didn't really have the faintest idea, as nobody else does, is what is an optimum advisory fee from the point of view of investors and a decent return on the part of industry. So the government, while there may be a feeling that the present method of setting management fees leads to an unfair fee, the focus is really on the method and not on the fee. So that the negotiation is not over the fee, but it's over the reform of the method of arriving at the fee. When you recast the issue that way, rather than saying arguing about the level of fees, there is room for compromise, and that's what we ultimately did with respect to fees.
Is this some insight that you got by being in a regulatory?
Yes, very much so. I had a good deal of trouble persuading the industry of the things that I'm saying right now, especially those people who believe that the government are a bunch of no-goodnicks out to get us. I had to do a good deal of missionary work around the country.
Did you have to do any within the ICI?
No, within the executive committee of members, we were blessed with a particularly enlightened group of people who, while representing a range of views, were simply amenable to a discussion and reconciliation of differences, and didn't start with intransigent ideological positions. So basically, the difference between what the SEC was requesting, and that is that, quote, in legal terms, and that management fees, quote, be reasonable, unquote, was changed to a formulation in which the advisor was deemed to have a fiduciary responsibility to the funds with respect to the fees. Now, it was our feeling, and one I was able to successfully persuade the industry on, it, there was a much greater difference between those two formulations than appeared on the surface. That requirement that fees be, quote, reasonable, unquote, would put the duty on a judge to engage in a rate-making proceeding, or would force the court in that direction. Based not only on my experience, again, with the agency, with the SEC, but going back to my prior experience as a law clerk to a federal judge for 2 years in the district court, I thought I had a pretty good insight as to the way the courts approach these kinds of issues. And my insight here was that the courts are much more comfortable with passing on a process and the decency of a process than they are in trying to come up with numbers. They're not economists. They're not accountants. The studies are always equivocal that the parties come in with. And so the necessity of coming up with a number is something which is not really part of the historic judicial function. We leave it to juries usually to come up with numbers with review on the part of the court. However that may be, nevertheless, courts are much more familiar with process and more comfortable with process. And so the imposition of a duty, a fiduciary duty on advisors, would more clearly lead to a process orientation on the part of the courts than the term reasonable, which was is a rate-making term. And I think history has borne out the fact that we were correct in that kind of distinction. Of course, we don't know what would have happened if the word reasonable had been put in, but we felt that process would be more easily achieved through the fiduciary duty approach. Other kinds of problems also were amenable to a informed negotiating stance than simply a confrontation between industry and the SEC. For example, we on the question of sales charges, it was determined to, as part of a compromise, that sales charge levels be essentially delegated to the NASD. Subject to review by the commission, as they have the authority to review other NASD rules and regulations. However, we did, as one of our negotiating points, insisted that the standard would have to also provide for reasonable compensation to sales personnel, so that you had a double standard, reasonable from the point of view of investors and reasonable from the point of view of providing for reasonable compensation for sales personnel. We ran into tremendous arguments with the commission staff, who wanted unfettered commission review power based upon the charge to investors alone. And here, an understanding of the imperatives that drive the staff in situations like this is very different than what people in industry would think those imperatives are. Here, the imperative really was that in the various review authority that the commission has over the self-regulatory organizations, they didn't want one of them suddenly circumscribed in a way that could lead to similar demands on the part of other self-regulatory organizations for various kinds of limitations on the commission's review power. Now, in this kind of situation, the industry thinks they're only looking at their thing, and they say if they don't want to provide for reasonable compensation to salespeople, and they're arguing against that, they really must have something terrible in mind for the industry. Yet, we achieved the same result, which the substantive result was not the result being quarreled with by the staff, although they didn't know it at the beginning. But when we simply suggested that the NESD's initial authority be circumscribed by the requirement that there be reasonable compensation to sales personnel, but leaving the commission's review power unfettered, we would achieve exactly the same result, because the commission's review power over a standard which included reasonable compensation could be plenary, but nevertheless would have to allow for reasonable compensation, because that's what the basic standard would be. And the commission accepted that without quarrel. So I went into this rather tedious explanation merely to show that there's always a lot going on when you're discussing matters between industry and government, and you have to understand the imperatives that are driving government to take certain positions, which have very little to do with the worst case scenarios that people in the industry dream about in their nightmares at night. It's for that reason that over the years, at least during my tenure and at the ICI, and I suspect my successors take the same point of view, that lobbying as such has to be under the control of people technically proficient with the matters at issue. That you can get the smartest lobbyist in the world who will do the job diligently and learn about the matter that they're lobbying about, but nevertheless will miss opportunities that will almost always present themselves along the way to reach a decent compromise from the viewpoint of industry, because they just don't see a crack that someone technically proficient in the area would see as opening a route to a reasonable outcome.
Which comes from having a sense of what's underlying things, what you can't see.
A familiarity, as I say, with the imperatives driving government, which are different than the imperatives driving industry.
Well, you talked about talking about lobbying, and I want to get some sense during this period, this 4-year period, who were the key players? Who were you talking to on the Hill?
Senator Sparkman's staff, Senator Bennett, not the present Senator Bennett, his father, on the Republican side. Congressman Moss on the House side. No, M-O-S-S from California. California. I don't remember the senior Republican. He was in Massachusetts and represented the Cranberry Bogs. Just don't quite remember his name. Harrison Williams, under Senator Sparkman, and at the end was, I think, chairman of the committee when the legislation was actually enacted. There were, you know, last-ditch opponents on the part of the industry who, down to the very last day, the last voting on the bill by the Senate committee, were trying to do their best to scuttle the whole thing. But I think that the outcome of the legislative program was positive. It was, I think, a win-win situation for the government and for the industry.
Were all these different legislators, the folks that are in the offices you talked about earlier, did you have to negotiate different interests that just came from ideology or came from, you know, who they represented? Was that a challenge, dealing with Senator so-and-so and
To an extent, but basically this legislative package was looked upon as being so complex that not a matter of great public outcry, as you one of your first questions suggested, that the both on the Senate and the House side, it was left to staff to a much larger extent than was conventional at that time.
So did it take 4 years because it was so complex?
Yes, and just a long time to simply work out both the substantive compromises and B, to bring the industry around to speaking with a unified voice. Also, the fact that we successfully resisted the legislation for 2 years, I think, probably put the commission in a disposition to compromise where they would not have on day one.
Was that a conscious strategy? Hold them off for a while so they cooperate?
I don't think it was a conscious right. I think everybody was aware of that kind of thing, but I don't. That was not the strategy. The strategy was really trying to formulate an industry position on the merits. Whether it was going to be a fight to the death or a compromise was uncertain, but the public facade had to be resisting it while we were doing that work. I think that, from my personal point of view, again, I'm talking about my own personal fortunes here, that I probably accumulated a good deal of equity on the part of capital, put it that way, with the industry because of what was generally conceived as a successful outcome of that legislative endeavor, and it probably made my job much easier for the remaining 10 years or so that I was president of the ICI.
I seem to recall there being some sort of deadline imposed to get this thing done by the end of the year or something like that.
Yeah, I think it was Senator Sparkman who one day sort of read at one of the hearings, which was well attended by industry people, kind of read the Riot Act that unless there was agreement between the industry and the commission that the committee would impose a solution. I think that's probably what you're referring to. That was, I can't exactly remember, but it would certainly would have been something that was helpful to those of us who were trying to reach a compromise with the commission. There are a lot of things to work out. For example, limitations on performance fees. The commission wanted to ban performance fees. We finally negotiated this deal where you could have a symmetrical performance fee. You could get a performance fee for good performance, positive, but you had to get a negative, cutting your fee for underperformance of the benchmark. So these were compromises that were sort of very logical compromises on a lot of stuff, which really didn't were not compromises in the sense that anyone's position was being compromised, but the solution was to move to a different plateau rather than any kind of, you know, one is at 5 and one is at 10 and you say 7.5. Not that kind of compromise. We're trying to find more creative solutions to the problems that the commission perceived as wrong with the industry, which you know, most people in the industry would say, well, you know, it's not like the commission says, but maybe they have a point in what they're saying. And that is the spur to, is the crack in the door, so to speak.
Is this the point at which front-end load funds were taken out of play?
Yes. That was a very specific problem because it was only a minority of the industry that had the very high 50% first year front-end load. The solution, which was spread load and refunds, etc., were really worked out by a man by the name of Bob Loeffler, who was on our executive committee, who was a senior vice president of IDS, which was the largest front-end load group at that time. He's passed away, but he was a man of broad vision, and from the beginning was working on that compromise. So that was really the one aspect which we deferred to the staff of the Institute had less to do with than the other recommendations.
And IDS would have very good reason to come up with an alternative, given that this was so much of their business.
Yes, and also that the Commission had a strong case.
Which was?
That someone who redeemed through change of economic circumstances at the end of the first year would lose 50% of his or her money. Summing up in one sentence. That, by the way, pattern of charges is a carryover from the insurance industry. That's the way insurance commissions work and work to this day.
The insurance is a different animal.
Well, there's always been a lot of arguments about that. Yes, to an extent, insurance is a different animal. But if, let's say, sales charges are too high in the insurance industry, you could get more life insurance for the same dollar. So the problem is not that different. And second, and this is one problem that is an insoluble problem under our present pattern of securities regulation, is that the insurance industry and the securities industry compete for salesmen, salespeople. And a lot of these folks are indifferent as to what it is that they're selling as between financial products. And so there is a inter-industry competitive problem or a level playing field problem when one segment of an industry who compete for the same retail outlets being when there's differential regulation involved. So that's a problem which has never been solved in our country. In England, for example, the Financial Services Authority, the FSA, has complete jurisdiction over all financial products. I'm not certain how this is worked out. It's still there. Universal jurisdiction is still too new, I think, to have done much with respect to competitive considerations, inter-industry competitive situations. But it's a very interesting project to follow and see what would be done. Here, it's impossible. Anyway, moving on, if you want me to move on with the ICI.
You talked about this 4-year period, and I think the emphasis that this puts you in a good position to leave the CICI starting in the 70s. I want to talk about once you've moved through this somewhat transformative period where we have the new legislation and basically a new set of rules. What were your goals for the organization, and what did you feel like the organization needed to accomplish long term?
Well, the outcome of the legislative program in 1970 had a lot of spin-off, not only personal to me, but personal in another sense. The Institute moved from New York to Washington. I think we were early in the parade of trade associations that moved from the locus of their the businesses they represented to recognizing that the action was in Washington and not in Peoria. Even the ABA moved from Chicago to Washington in the mid-70s. I very much felt that the Institute should have a proactive program rather than being in a situation of responding to government regulation. As the opportunities presented themselves, there were certain goals which I had in mind from the beginning. One was to find a tax advantaged program for the backbone of the industry's investors, which were, you might call, small investors. Because one of the basic genius of the open-end fund is its redeemability. redeemability of net asset value at any time. But of course, at the same time, there's a tremendous vulnerability of the industry, is that everybody can leave tomorrow. So you can't just stand still when you're you have an open-end fund. And one of the, both on the sales side and the retention side, would be a tax-advantaged situation which would encourage people to enter mutual funds, but also to remain. And as the 70s progressed, and there were general economic feeling that the United States was suffering from a lack of capital formation, and therefore more general atmosphere congenial to the idea of tax incentives for capital formation, we seized that opportunity to argue for a investor-directed tax program which would achieve the goals that we that I just mentioned. And I went back and looked, and I found this press release of May 16th, 1979, when I unveiled at a general membership meeting the idea of a universal scheme for, at that time, tax relief for investment in equities, since, as I say, the sort of the national feeling of capital formation is reflected by equities, not just savings generally. The plan we unveiled talked about equities, and as the release said, in unveiling this program at a general membership meeting, higher levels of capital formation are urgently needed to modernize and revitalize America's industrial base. The plan would give an investor a tax deduction in the years that investments are made in equities. Any earnings on the investment would be tax sheltered. The principles are the same as those which apply to KEO retirement plans, which are small business retirement plans, and could be subject to the same $7,500 a year limitation. I have little doubt that such a program would act as a mighty stimulus, Mr. Silver told the Institute's annual meeting. The evidence was not theoretical because France, Canada, Japan had all recently adopted specific tax incentives to spur investment. And basically, I presented the scheme that existed in France called the Loi Monterey, which had been very successful in encouraging average French citizens to invest in equities, which were not that popular in France.
But was your sense that we needed the legislation to create the tax opportunity? At that time, is that what you were thinking when you were suggesting the creation of something similar to what was in France?
I'm not quite sure I get the...
Well, you needed something that would take advantage of a tax loophole, or there would be something in the United States tax code that would make this possible.
The enactment of tax legislation that would make this possible.
Right.
Again, under the, as I say, if not a consensus, at least a national feeling that something should be done to increase capital formation and encourage investors to invest in equities, presumably. So we set about first by unveiling this plan, and second to contacting our sometimes rival, sometimes friendly financial trade associations to see if we could present a common front. Now, each of them had their own ideas of what kind of tax breaks they would like for their industry. And they set about, and that they each came up with their own plans. We were, at the Institute, very, very fortunate in having, as historic outside tax counsel, a man who just passed away very recently, Eddie Cohen, who was one of the great tax theoretical minds in this country and recognized as such for decades, who had represented the Institute back before there was even an Institute, represented the industry since 1936, and was responsible for the basic taxation of mutual funds, which involve a pass-through to investors, so to avoid double taxation. Eddie was recognized by Washington organizations, Washington-based trade associations, as being one of the great minds. So we were able to, in the meetings we had, bring Eddie along, and which is very helpful. And we developed the strategy of saying to all these other organizations, look, we have a plan which for you might not be quite as good as the plan you're developing for yourself. But our plan will work for all of the financial institutions. And therefore, why don't you give us a second place endorsement? That if your plan isn't going anywhere legislatively, sign on to our plan. And they did, by and large, and that was the birth of the universal IRA. It ended up as the IRA legislation, which accounts, I think, for 10% of the assets of the mutual fund industry now, if I'm not mistaken. And I think it's been a very, very good deal for the industry and for the investing public.
So in Congress, did all these other financial groups, trade groups, did they all introduce theirs and everything washed out that the IRA?
Well, no. What basically happened is that it was all mostly behind the scenes. Discussions up on the Hill with the tax writing committees, with the Treasury, etc. And it was pretty clear that the IRA was going to get more support. And so I think by the time it came along, it was a pretty universal agreement. We also during the there were the '70s, however, were not a good time for the equity markets.
Right.
And the equity funds were not, performance was a problem. We were faced with an aging shareholder population. And then, of course, came the period of hyperinflation following the first oil crisis and the birth of money market funds. Probably 10 years ago, everybody would remember what Regulation Q was. Today it requires, I think, an explanation. Regulation Q limited banks to paying 5% interest on savings accounts. SNLs, I think, were given a slight break. I think they could pay 5 1/8. And that was always a subject of internecine warfare between the banking industry and the SNL industry, who were number two, one and two as far as lobbying capacity in Washington and around the country. But with interest rates rapidly exceeding the 5% level, and indeed ultimately going to 16% short-term rates, the money market fund rapidly became a contender for savings dollars, as well as the historic industry approached investment dollars, all long-term savings dollars in the sense of bond funds. But as far as short-term, short savings vehicles, we had none. And the money market fund filled a tremendous hole, as I saw it and others saw it, in the industry's product line.
Well, this is the period of net redemptions.
Yes.
So that would be the hole right
there. Right.
Can you be a little more specific on the reasons for that period setting in? You mentioned that equities in general were not doing well. Was there more to it, though, that particularly hit mutual funds?
I think possibly disappointed expectations on the part of investors. But there were no specific scandals or...
Right. You talked about an aging...
shareholder population, yeah. At the same time, we were trying to, from a marketing point of view, because we did perform some overall marketing initiatives for the industry. We were trying to encourage the so-called family of funds concept, because technology has been the biggest driver, the biggest hidden driver in the whole securities, financial world that you could possibly imagine or not imagine for changes in products, services, organization of the industry. There had always been the ability among many fund groups for investors to transfer their money from fund A to fund B within the same complex without any payment of sales charges, but with a very small $5 administrative fee. As technology made it possible, these sort of rights of transfer became much more efficient and easy for the funds to offer this as a routine service at a very inexpensive or nominal cost to themselves or to their investors. So this sort of facilitated the idea of a family of funds concept, or as a fund for all seasons, so to speak. But there was that hole of the safe haven. You could find safety in bond funds, but they are amenable to short-term swings as interest rates change. The money market fund created the potential for a vehicle which would be a savings account, would be a safe haven in times when if you wanted to get out of the market or the bond market and just put your money in a safe interest-bearing account. So as we became aware of those first money market funds, we saw a tremendous potential of completing the industry's product line and finally closing the circle on the family of funds concept, which now meant that if there was a market break, you no longer had to take your money out of mutual funds and put it in a bank somewhere, but you could keep your money within the fund group, so you remained the customer of that fund group. And as the investment climate changed, you could switch back. This is not, you know, this is not rocket science, but filled a real need as we saw it, and also was a wonderful way of retaining customers.
The way you're putting this is interesting, because, and it's not what I would have expected. You're really talking about you know, creating another service that complements given the situation, I would think that your first thought would be, at last we've got something that can compete in this era of high interest rates. You know, because essentially the equity funds aren't surviving, they're not competitive, so you've got your net redemption, and money market gives you a way to, you know, create something that will keep pace with inflation.
Right. No, that was certainly there. I'm speaking now from the point of view of sitting at the trade association and observing these developments in the industry and looking at all these factors. And I chose the one that I've been stressing as one which would not be readily apparent as to what the significance of money market funds were to be. So somewhat countering the suggestion you just mentioned, there were a lot of people in the industry who said, hey, wait a second. Money market funds are not going to be very lucrative to the industry. There isn't... It's not the most difficult managerial investment managerial problem to manage a money market fund portfolio. We have to keep fees at the barest minimum because you're not promising capital growth at all. And some people may actually choose the money market fund as against an equity fund. So we may be creating a vehicle which would be counterproductive in the long run. Now, those were sort of negative features, not shared by everybody in the industry, but it was a sort of a minor theme. Because these were new and weren't thoroughly understood. The full potential that I was mentioning was not apparent, particularly. We then did the very first study, which I unveiled, I have it here somewhere, in a speech, again at the annual membership meeting. Did our first study of money market fund shareholders. And basically, my message, I unveiled the preliminary results in my talk. Basically, the message is we're saved. That we now have 5 million money market fund shareholders. They are an unusual amount of college graduates among them. And an astounding amount of those 5 million have graduate degrees beyond college. They're 15 or 20 years younger than our shareholder base. And that these are going to be our shareholders of the future. You're going to be able to sell your full product line to these new shareholders. And 5 million never owned mutual funds before. By that time, I think that a good deal of a good part of the industry were waiting for that kind of message. They had started to observe some of these things themselves. Of course, while all this was going on from a marketing point of view and an industry point of view, our competitors were not resting on their huge amounts of money in savings accounts. They decided they would try to do away with money market funds. And it's something we knew would happen. It was almost inevitable that it would happen. First, they tried for legislation on the federal level to essentially kill money market funds. And there were hearings before the Congress. Interestingly enough, we found that while the really powerful lobbies of the banking and S&L industries had kept the bank regulators and the Congress nominally sympathetic to Regulation Q, and that beneath the surface and behind the scenes, regulatory people from the Fed on down were not comfortable with this idea of limiting interest rates. And that became apparent at the hearings that were held on the federal level. when the Fed disapproved of legislation to knock out money market funds. And the director of the National Credit Union regulator turned up in opposition to the legislation to knock out money market funds. And when the SEC turned up, which would be more expected, to say, look, we regulate money market funds and there's no reason why anyone should think that they're unsafe vehicles. So that where the political will in Washington didn't exist to knock out Regulation Q, to knock out Regulation Q, this translated into not knocking out money market funds, because it was seen that this was the market's answer to Regulation Q, and indeed, within a couple of years, Regulation Q was gone. But we recognized that the lobbies involved, as I said, the bank and S&L lobbies were number one and number two in size all around the country. And the mutual fund and securities industry generally, from a lobbying point of view, do not have the weapons that the other financial trade associations do. So you look around the country, thousands of branch offices of banks. Banks are pillars of the local economy all over the country. So you have the money centers in the states are in the banks. Thousands of branch managers and employees of the banks and the S&Ls. Go to the insurance industry. Thousands and thousands of insurance salesmen all over the state. So in other words, most of the great financial trade associations are able to muster a huge grassroots constituency, both to affect federal and state regulation. Securities industry has absolutely nothing to match that. And the mutual fund industry is in the worst position. Our member base was Massachusetts, the historic home of the mutual fund industry, some on Wall Street, and some centered in California, and one or two outliers in Kansas City and Minneapolis, and also, and not labor-intensive organizations, not the thousands and thousands of salesmen and branch offices.
So it was never an option to have the lobbying firepower.
No, that was impossible. And as this heated up, it struck me that, and we had to obviously gear up for what was going to be a huge legislative fight around the country. And assessing our strengths and weaknesses, it occurred to me we had one tremendous strength, and that is that we had actually achieved the goal of every marketing person, and that is product superiority. Banks are paying 5% on savings accounts, we're paying 15%. However, it's interesting how this oral history project has made me remember things that I've really forgotten. because it also occurred to me that product superiority was not necessarily enough. And I remembered a New Yorker article a long, long time ago when fluoridated toothpaste first came along, before fluorine was in the waters. And the New Yorker article, the details of which I don't remember, but went into great detail on how in the toothpaste industry it was every marketing person's dream to come ahead to really invent a toothpaste that was better than anybody else's toothpaste. Yet Crest or whoever the first one was didn't sweep the competitive field. That you were not able to automatically win the competitive race by coming up with a better product. So it seemed to me that we had the potential for winning the race legislatively. There was enough static could be generated, enough misunderstanding and other impediments to not being able to automatically say we're a better product than we win.
People still wanted their passport to go downtown.
Exactly. And so we had to find a way of bringing our message to the public, which short-circuited the normal processes. We didn't have the salesman, we didn't have the branch offices, etc. And so we decided, well, the first thing I did was call a meeting of members and say, we got a problem and I need money and I need $1 million. And the dispute that I got was, both overtly and behind the scenes, was he doesn't really understand it because it's going to cost a lot more than $1 million. And therefore, do they really understand that the ICI had a handle for the problem? And they were prepared to put up more than $1 million. So I called this meeting, and I had about 2 or 3 page paper analyzing the situation, the political situation as I saw it, and how we could combat it. Number one on the list, something which is commonplace today, but wasn't then, was radio advertising. Some you could get on very, very quickly. You could give your message, and it wasn't terribly expensive. Second, we had to gear up a legislative team for every state. We needed a good intelligence system to determine what was going on in the states. Since there were going to be we could think there would be legislative hearings in a number of states. We had to get a corner on the securities law professors in the states to be able to testify on our side. Problem: most securities law professors knew nothing about the Investment Company Act. It's always been the stepchild of securities law. Solution: you had to be able to give the securities law professors some comfort, and therefore we had to retain a nationally respected securities law authority, and we settled on Dick Jennings at Stanford, Lou Ross at Harvard, and Dick Jennings at Stanford were the two great national experts who would be known to every securities law professor in the country. And so that under the shelter of the national expert, you can give comfort to the local securities law professor that he was not being asked to join a venture which was unsound legally.
So if Jennings says it's okay, then it must be okay.
Well, at least he tells me where to look in the act, and I can check out what he's saying, rather than these guys from Washington telling me that this is all good on the up and up. Well, we did create a national uproar, as I'm sure others have told you, but I don't think anybody would probably. Only this. We even made Doonesbury.
Oh, right. Not famous. We definitely need to get a copy. Let me take a second of that.
Okay.